Okay, hello and welcome to or welcome back to Colonial Outcast. My name is Greg Stoker. I'm joined by what we can now probably call a returning political analyst, Alina Xenofontes. She's based out of London. And today we are going to be talking about BRICS, Belt and Road, the continuing drama and escalation between Israel, Iran, and the West, and a couple of spending packages that are in the works because, you know, the U.S., their main modus operandi of solving problems is just throwing money at it and hoping, you know, for the best. So to that end, we've all been tracking the drama unfolding between Israel and Iran. It began on April 1st with Israel bombing a Iranian consulate in Damascus, which was a direct attack on Iranian sovereignty. They had to respond. They took 2 weeks to do it. A lot of back channeling and coordination happened, and they finally did it this past Saturday. This episode is being recorded on April 18th, by the way. And Iran shot over 300 munitions, a mixture of drones and medium-range ballistic missiles. Some got through, hit Nevatim Air Force Base and occupied Niqab. And it was a kind of a chess move. It gave Israel the opportunity to say that their Iron Dome system worked and the Iranian operation was a failure. And it gave Iran the opportunity to say, like, hey, we can hit their military targets with our old equipment. We didn't even use our new fancy Cadillac stuff. So it was basically a perfect opportunity for Iran and way for Iran to restore deterrence, for Israel to save face and run their propaganda machines into overtime and give themselves an excuse not to respond to Iran, because Iran has said, this time if Israel retaliates, we're going to respond disproportionately. So the game has always been de-escalation. The U.S. says that they don't want anything to do with this drama unfolding between Israel and Iran that will destabilize the entire region. However, the Cradle Media has reported that there's back-channel communications going on between the U.S. diplomats and diplomats in Tehran, asking Iran to allow a saving face, a symbolic strike or retaliation against Iran by Israel, so Israel can save face, and Israel and Iran has shot that down. So coming out of Al Jazeera today, it seems like there's a rumor that the Biden administration will allow an assault on Rafah if Israel agrees to a limited strike on Iran. So all of this is unconfirmed. It's absurd. It makes no sense. So we're going to still wait and see how that situation develops. Iran says if this continues to escalate, they will, and this was being reported by Haaretz, they will review their nuclear doctrine. So great. You know, what a wonderful time to be alive. And this is unprecedented territory, and the situation is developing rapidly, and we'll continue to discuss this. But in terms of making predictions, Israel's kind of a rogue actor, and we unconditionally support them. So it's anyone's guess. All right. So moving on, we have a new narrative being constructed since the Iranian topic's heating up and there's an ongoing war in Ukraine. So Republican House Speaker Mike Johnson, is a kind of an odd character. He has you may know him because he shares a porn monitoring app with his son that sends each other like notifications if they're watching adult content, which if I received that while a notification that my father was like opening something up, I think I'd literally die. But you know, the far right evangelical Christians are a completely different type of person. So anyways, Mike Johnson, he's made a decision to support aid for Ukraine, Israel, and Taiwan, yet another foreign aid package paid by you, the American taxpayer, and I'm sure the UK will have their own, despite the potential party backlash. He's a Republican. Republicans have like turned on the war on Ukraine. They don't want to fund it anymore. And this comes after he labeled Xi, Vladimir Putin, and Iran as a, quote, axis of evil. So they're kind of revitalizing the old term that started in World War II, was reused and rehashed again in 2001 and 2002 when the Bush administration wanted to justify the invasion of Iraq, the global axis of terror. And this move is seen as essential for bipartisan approval of a $95 billion funding package for these allies, with President Biden strongly backing the package to counter the influence of Iran and Russia and to stand with allies. So that's why we've asked Alina to come on, because she knows quite a bit about this, the influence that is growing out of Iran, Russia, China, Brazil, with institutions or organizations like BRICS, which we're going to discuss in this episode, and China's Belt and Road Initiative, which is very important in terms of understanding geopolitics at this moment in history. So before we get into this, Alina, thanks so much for coming on to walk us through this.
Thanks. It's always lovely to be on, Greg. It's always great.
Okay. So before we get into this, we need to start defining terms for the audience. So could you give us like a brief definition of colonialism through like the in terms of the Western, sorry, not in colonialism, imperialism in the Western sense?
Okay, yeah. So basically, imperialism is the domination of all other groups of peoples and entities for the purpose of profit and gain for a minority group of peoples. So it's premised essentially on warfare, colonialism, and by colonialism, it can be whether it's military colonialism, debt colonialism, finance colonialism, it's irrelevant, or inequality and sustaining that inequality. And in actuality, the very theories of colonialism are actually rooted in Marxist thought. And you know, it's irrelevant as to whether you agree with Marx or don't agree with Marx. That doesn't really matter. What matters is that Marx's analysis of capitalism is actually what provided the framework by which we understand imperialism and how imperialism works. And it is contingent to capitalist survival. And the reason I say this is because in theory, right, capitalism, there's something called the tendency of the rate of profit to fall, right? Very briefly, just to explain what that is. The tendency of rate of profit to fall in capitalism is when essentially when, say, a factory or an industry is able to reach a level of innovation where they're able to produce any particular product, let's just say, far cheaper, in the long run, they'll be able to obviously underscore the competitors by being able to produce cheaper and therefore producing something at far more affordable prices for the consumer. But eventually, in the long run, as that is going to be picked up by the competitors, what essentially happens is that they will then also be able to provide things for cheaper. And as demand remains equal, there's a tendency for the rate of profit to fall. And this wasn't something that was exclusive to Marx. Marx just sort of explored it. But every classical economist, whether it's Adam Smith or David Ricardo, also basically came to the same conclusion. So the idea here is, in order to sustain profit making, which is the basis of capitalism, right? I mean, in the words of Milton Friedman, making profit is the goal of capitalism. In order to sustain making a bulk of profit, you need to find other means by which to create that profit. And that's where imperialist mediums, let's say, come into play. So whether that's through colonizing states elsewhere, economic colonization, international economic trade discrepancies, and basically sustaining inequality by which then certain groups of people can exploit the inequalities, and by exploiting them, they're able to make profit. Therefore, it serves them, it serves a particular class of people to keep people subjugated that they are then able to profit off of consistently. That's like a little brief overview.
Yeah, and to make it kind of more relatable to the average person, it's like our lifestyle in the global north is kind of facilitated by, you know, in some ways, the blood of the global south. We're able to, you know, make electronics affordable and all of these commodities affordable to us within our own market economy, because, you know, we have access through colonization and imperialism and exploitation of the global South to a bevy of cheap resources and cheap labor that, you know, over centuries we have put in systems to be able to exploit with impunity. So,
yeah, I mean, it's sort of like when the British colonized India, they prevented India from developing an industrial capacity, and they were focused on merchant trade. Or in the same way, when the U.S. had particular political control over Venezuela, and they had basically just turned Venezuela into an oil producing industry, like the whole country was just a pumping oil machine without actually giving it the capacity to grow and innovate industrially, which is what you need to grow your economy. So essentially what happens is that now you have the vast majority of the global South merely producing low value added goods in the forms of agriculture, textiles, and basic resources, whereas the developed world appropriated as well a lot of the wealth from the global South, was able to become innovative, and its industrial capacity allowed it to grow, which then creates an inequality that they're able to exploit.
Yeah, and you write here in some of your show notes that imperialism strives to sustain regions in impoverished states. Dollarization, libertarian free market values, and globalization all sustain poverty, debt, inequality, and thus preserve imperialism via neo-colonial means.
Yeah, so I mean, even something as simple as what was the NAFTA, but now it's become the North America, Mexico-Canada Free Trade Agreement, right? The whole concept of libertarian economic policies and free trade is premised on the idea of sustaining one country at a level of poverty so that they can exploit. What do I mean? So obviously you have Mexico, who has its own economic realities. You have the United States and you have Canada, who are obviously far more economically developed. And what essentially happens through free trade, which means that there's freedom of movement of goods and services between these three nation states. The United States, for example, or a company based in the United States can basically place itself in Mexico, exploiting lower wages, being able to therefore keep its profits up high. This costs the average working class person in the United States from a possible job, but it also sustains low wages in Mexico, for instance. It doesn't actually help promote an increase in the overall standard of living, because you have something called the race to the bottom as well, right? Where a lot of these poor states will also have favorable tax systems even, and other means by which to attract business that then the capitalist entity is able to exploit. And then what happens with this free trade is that the corporations are making a load of money. They're becoming increasingly affluent. They're not in this case, let's just say Mexico is not allowing workers to be able to increase their wages on average, because then they will no longer be competitive. And from that point, it costs the working class in the United States. And in the meantime, the corporate elite is making huge levels of profit. But they need that inequality. They need places like Mexico. They need places like, Nigeria or Ghana, who have huge economic disparities with them, in order to be able to sustain the status quo and exploit policies, cheap labor, and cheap resources.
Right. And so that's where BRICS comes in. And and just to give the most layman definition, this is literally something you can look up on Wikipedia. So BRICS is an intergovernmental organization comprising Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa, initially, which is where the acronym BRICS comes from. It also includes Egypt, Ethiopia, Iran, the UAE. It was originally identified to highlight investment opportunities. The grouping evolved into a cohesive geopolitical bloc, with their governments meeting annually at formal summits and coordinating multilateral policies since 2009. Bilateral relations amongst BRICS are conducted mainly on the basis of non-interference, equality, and mutual benefit. Obviously, that's incredibly reductive about what BRICS is, but it's kind of seen by some as an opposition to Western hegemony coming from Europe and North America.
Yeah, so what BRICS essentially is, like you said, it's an intergovernmental organization, but it provides a basis by which nation states are able to engage in bilateral trade agreements that serve them, but also ability to bypass the use of the dollar. So when you have bilateral trade agreements done, say, in local currencies, this actually helps the in question states be able to pay for imports and exports in their local currencies and therefore not be so dependent on the dollar. So then we're going back to the dollarization of the world, which is another means of control, right? Because when you require dollars to be able to pay for international trade, it means that your currency is constantly depreciating because you need to keep buying the dollar so that you can engage in international trade. And what that does, especially to the third world, or not third world, rather the global south, as it's called, is that it depreciates their economy and constantly sends them in a spiral of greater indebtedness because where they need to then borrow more and more in order to be able to engage in international trade. So with organizations like BRICS, giving nation states the ability to be able to engage in international trade in their own local currencies, therefore not having to rely anymore so heavily on the dollar, it allows them a bit of space to breathe and to prevent further devaluation of their currency and to possibly be able to purchase industrial capacity at more affordable prices for these economies that require industrial capacity in order to be able to grow and prosper.
Yeah, and a lot of people, a lot of capitalists don't really like the idea of BRICS because, you know, the de-dollarization is a threat to United States interests and even to United States foreign policy. Just see what happened to Gaddafi in Libya when he made a massive push to de-dollarize in North Africa. There was, you know, Hillary Clinton came in and a bunch of other special interests came in, you know, with their kink for regime change wars. And that's all she wrote. I mean, Libya is still a shambles. There's still ISIL in the south and, you know, civil war going on, you know, and that's the price for, you know, exactly. Sometimes going against the imperialist masters.
Exactly, because the dollar is how they're able to essentially control economies and control by controlling debt, they're able to control your local economy, what you can and cannot afford, if you can and cannot industrialize, and it essentially controls your entire political establishment. I mean, how are you supposed to have autonomy when the debt and then through debt, the Federal Reserve is controlling your state? I mean, something similar on a side note with what's happening right now, even in Argentina, who's one of the most indebted nations in the world to the IMF, what's essentially happening there, the IMF is essentially controlling the entirety of the Argentinian state. It's become essentially a financial colony of the United States. So it actually prevents nation states from having the ability to govern themselves. And this is, like I said, another form of colonialism. And so when BRICS comes and offers something that is drastically different, of course, this is going to be appealing to an emerging global South that wants to find alternatives where they're no longer going to be so desperate and dependent on the dollar and on the West to define the terms of how they'll run their economy. And one small thing I feel like I have to say here is that when the acronym BRICS was initiated, it was actually just Brazil, Russia, India, and China. South Africa was added in 2010. But the basis for that acronym originated by Goldman and Sachs in the early 2000s. And it was basically based on a report and a study that found that these four nations were going to become essentially by 2050 the dominant economies of the world. So even that on its own is a threat to the West. So here you have four emerging economies that are growing at such rapid rates that it was going to threaten Western hegemony. And Western hegemony, or the idea of hegemony, is the very definition of imperialism. So the fact that now there's an entire institution, intergovernmental organization, that's also attracting so many other nation states, because as we saw on January 1st of 2024, we had what's called now BRICS Plus. So we have Iran joined, Saudi Arabia joined BRICS, the UAE, Egypt, Ethiopia, and Argentina, although then Argentina pulled out last minute when Milei was voted into power. So it just goes to show how many more people now are being drawn to this idea of looking for alternatives.
Right. And, you know, I think the Israel-Palestine conflict has really highlighted Western hypocrisy and how all these liberal institutions, like, they may sound good, they may have a veneer of, you know, nobility and justice to them, but it's all hypocrisy. Like, we mentioned the IMF earlier, just now, and if you're not familiar, it's the International Monetary Fund. And it's generally described and accepted to be debt colonialism. But this is the liberal framing of what the IMF is. The IMF is a major financial agency of the United Nations and an international financial institution funded by 190 member countries. Oh, so it must be legitimate, right? If so many people are buying into it, with headquarters in Washington, D.C., you know, the United States capital. It's regarded as the global lender of last resort to national governments and a leading supporter of exchange rate stability, i.e. dollarization. Its stated mission is working to foster global monetary cooperation, secure financial stability, facilitate international trade, promote high employment and sustainable economic growth, and reduce poverty around the world, which is actually not what happens in practice at all.
No.
Yeah.
And the thing is as well, every country that's part of the IMF, they don't really get a say. So right now, the United States is the only country in the IMF that has veto power. Essentially, they get to decide. They give the AOK where their money is going to go, because they're also the party that contributes most to the IMF. So they're the only veto power in the IMF. So again, that just shows that the IMF essentially is just a financial tool that is used to achieve a political aim. Throughout the world. So it's a political tool of oppression, and it's a political tool of imperialism in order to preserve itself as the hegemon and to continue to subjugate, especially former colonized states, to never reach that point of industrial capacity and innovation. And I think that's where BRICS comes in and offers a great alternative. And that's also why the Belt and Road Initiative is a very interesting project to consider.
Let's start tying that all together. BRICS, Belt and Road, which can be seen as a challenge to the IMF in some ways, and then let's see why Mike Johnson is calling this cooperation between Iran, Russia, and China a new axis of evil. Is it because they're evil, or is it because they're just a challenge to the money? So let me pull this. Yeah. Let me pull this up real quick.
No worries.
Where did it go? Oh, geez. Okay. All right. This is one of your videos from earlier about this.
Okay, guys, so something that I feel is not being discussed with regards to the Iranian retaliation against Israel is the extent of Russia and China's involvement. So what needs to be understood here is that Russia, China, and Iran are in a significant geostrategical alliance. So that will be through BRICS, and the fact that Iran has been a newly inducted country into the BRICS organization. For those that don't know, BRICS is basically an acronym for Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa, and the BRI. Now, the Belt and Road Initiative has to be the most ambitious industrial project we have seen to date, and it is the birth child of China, who initiated the program in 2013 and invested at least $1 trillion in the program. Now, at least 150 countries around the world have actually signed up to the Belt and Road Initiative. And what the Belt and Road Initiative essentially is a mass web of infrastructure, whether it be in the form of railways, highways, maritime routes, throughout Asia, that would include East Asia, Western Asia, Africa, and Europe. Now, Iran is one of the most significant pieces of the Belt and Road Initiative, as not only is it going to provide a powerhouse of natural resources, but its particular geostrategical location will allow infrastructure to be built through Asia, into Western Asia, and into Europe. Now, given the fact that Russia, China, and Iran have all been heavily sanctioned by the United States through their abuse of the dollarization of the world, all three countries are looking towards the establishment of a multipolar reality and means and routes by which to bypass the dollarization of the world and to engage in economic trade without the control of the United States hegemony over international trade. Therefore, what needs to be understood here in the most simplistic and synopsized way I can possibly explain it is that any attack by Israel on Iran or by the United States on Iran not only risks destabilizing the entire region, it also runs runs the risk of effectively disrupting the Belt and Road Initiative that would be economically catastrophic, not just for China, but all the member states of BRICS, and especially China, Russia, and Iran. With that in mind, it begs the question, when Iran had essentially initiated its retaliatory attack against Israel, to what extent was Russia and China involved? Because as we've already stated, any attack on Iran could affect the economic prosperity and future and the very existence of China and Russia as we know it. Now, although this is purely speculative and I can't prove it, common sense dictates that when Iran retaliated against Israel for the bombing of the Iranian consulate in Damascus, Syria, it can only be concluded that any action taken by Iran was with the approval of Russia and China. We also have to bear in mind that beyond the fact that these countries are in a strong alliance with regards to the Belt and Road Initiative, but also now they're all part of the BRICS Association, they also have a military alliance. Russia, China, and Iran have routinely carried out military exercises and drills together, particularly in the area of the Red Sea. Therefore, the likelihood of China and Russia approving Iranian retaliation against Israel is incredibly high to almost, in my humble opinion, a certainty. Naturally, all three states would understand that any possible retaliation on behalf of the United States or the collective West, and Israel in particular, was very highly likely. So it can only be safe to assume that they have a scenario ready and a plan of action if any of the aforementioned states actually try to attack Iran. Now, what that scenario is and to what extent it will actually even directly involve China or Russia, I don't know. But what needs to be understood here is that when Iran attacked Israel, or rather retaliated against Israel, and rightfully so, executing its right under Article 51 of the UN Charter, it did so with the approval of two of the world's strongest superpowers, China and Russia. And that is very suggestive of what could follow.
All right, so a lot going on in that short condensed video. So let's spend the rest of the time kind of unpacking it.
Okay, well, I mean, like I said, so the BRI is obviously one of the most ambitious projects in terms of industrial production that we have seen to date, right? So it's pretty much bringing forth the old ancient Silk Road, and it's going to be basically bring together Asia, Africa, Europe, but even South America. So it's a very significant project. And the idea is to build a lot of infrastructure that is requisite for industrial production and to improve industrial capacity, particularly within nation states, whether it's in Africa, whether it's in the Middle East, who have not managed to accomplish that degree of industrial innovation. So whether it's railways, pipelines, highways, but of the most advanced sort of category, it will help and it will allow these nation states to basically start building an industrial economy. Well, these countries will start to develop industrial economies that will allow them to economically come out of the sort of low value added good based economies that they've had up until this point, whether it's agriculture, etc. And the BRI is therefore a major threat to the United States because, as I've said before, well, the U.S. elite, of course, the Western elite, because as I said before, the inequality is required in order for imperialism, capitalist imperialism, to succeed. And if you have these nation states now that they were exploiting for their cheap resources, starting to develop, obviously not right now, but in the long run, if they basically start joining the BRICS and are part of the BRI within the next 10 years, we could see a drastic change in the economic realities of these nation states that will no longer allow the West, the collective West, to be able to exploit them. And having said that, this is also very important, obviously, for China, Russia, and Iran to establish themselves geostrategically as offering something that's tangible, but also for their own economies, it's paramount that the BRI essentially works.
Yeah. And so we talk about the Belt and Road Initiative, and we've said that the IMF can be conceptualized as debt colonialism. One of my friends just defended her PhD dissertation on the Belt and Road Project, and her main assertion was like, it looks differently than the IMF does, but the Belt and Road Initiative in Africa and like in Pakistan, it's still a form of colonialism as well.
See, I would disagree with that. The reason I disagree with that, although we can't fully know the outcome because there's a lot of nuances here that you would need a whole other episode to get into. Mm-hmm. The reason I don't agree with that is because in this particular case, okay, so we have China providing loans, but the loans are essentially to build the infrastructure, which they are themselves building, right? Mm-hmm. But the idea is once the infrastructure is built, it's an idea of it should be paying itself once the economy starts to essentially boost and see the profits of the interconnectivity that's going to be created. And as that happens, you're going to be seeing nation states, as I said, grow economically, but not, and which therefore goes against the idea of, creating inequalities in order to suppress and then extract from. So here it's sort of a win-win situation. Of course, China's going to make its own, it's going to be protecting its own interests, securing itself. But at the same time, the countries that are going to become part of the BRI, particularly in the global south, are going to start seeing economic changes to their livelihoods that could see them gain more prominent positions of economic liberation, let's just say, that will not allow them to be consistently exploited. We need industrial capacity so that these nations can develop the wealth necessary so that they can grow and actually bring about some sort of drastic revolutionary changes within their own nation states. And of course, you know, this could go either way, right? But the idea of giving and providing industrial capacity is paramount to economic growth. Otherwise, if it's not that, then what we'll have is this continuation of finance capitalism. And finance capitalism, for its intents and purposes, is just basically rentier. And it's just extraction of resources whilst never really giving anything. And what we'll have is complete neo-feudalism. That's why I think it is different because of the prospects that one offers as opposed to the other.
Right. I mean, so would you say then that the West, you know, the NATO countries and like North America and stuff, they have a vested interest in maintaining the status quo in the global South then, essentially?
Yeah. Yeah. Because if they sustain the current dynamic of keeping Africa, for example, as a purely agricultural, resource-based continent that they can exploit, they'll be basically appropriating the cheap labor, appropriating resources, never really having to offer anything back. They'll be receiving cheap labor for essentially, which will allow them to profit off of. And these nation states will never have or never accumulate enough wealth to buy the type of machinery and tools needed to industrialize. This is the biggest problem, especially with dollarization and the trade inequality that basically happens. So that's why for the West, it's paramount that the status quo stays the way it is. And right now what China, Iran, and Russia are offering, well, it's not just China, Iran, and Russia, but let's just say the BRICS organization through the BRI is an alternative.
The new axis of evil.
The new axis of evil. And this kind of plays out to what's happening, what I said as well in the video that you've just shown. It is also playing out with regards to what's happening with Iran, because Iran is such a centerpiece to the BRI. When you take a look at the map, so, I mean, the entire Western Asian region is so geostrategically important. So you've got the Red Sea, you've got the Suez Canal, you've also got the Strait of Hormuz, which is by the Iranian coast. These are the most significant maritime trade routes that actually cut, reduce cost production, because it's much faster to essentially get shipments into Europe. So these particular trade routes are fundamental. So the entire region is also resource rich. It's very geostrategically important for the West as well as for BRICS. So Iran is right at the center of it. We've seen multiple trade routes coming through that are being built by the BRI. They're going to be going through Iran and basically could provide for the rest of the world, whether it's Africa, whether it's Europe. And any disruption to Iran or to that region as a whole could eventually bring down the entire BRI project. And this would be economically catastrophic for China, but also for Russia, and who are looking for alternatives to break away from dollarization and find alternative means by which to trade without the Western imperialist machine controlling it.
Yeah, and just as a historical observation, having the connector from, having the connector from China to the West go through Iran. That's the old Silk Road. But do you see any competition to this, Benjamin Netanyahu's and the European Union's push for the new Silk Road, the Mumbai to Abu Dhabi and Dubai, Middle East, up through the Arabian Peninsula, through Jordan, into Israel, to ports like Haifa and Ascalon, and then on into Europe as a competition to this Belt and Road project? Or do you think they're intertwined?
Yeah, this is the thing. They're trying to compete. Also, the Europeans have their one, which is called the EU Global Project. But the issue that I have with both of these, it's like, you know, when you look at the China Belt and Road Initiative, it initiated, it says officially in 2013, but they actually began works in 2011, especially in Yemen. This is also, this is actually why in 2015, the war in Yemen broke out with the US-led Saudi attack on the Houthis and Ansar Allah, because they wanted to basically take control over Yemen. At that point was working quite closely with China and established certain significant ports for the BRI, which then they sort of had to shut down during this particular, during the war, obviously, and only just now have continued. This is actually, just a little parenthesis, this is actually why China was the mediator between Saudi Arabia and Iran. And in doing so, they were able to establish peace, essentially, or end the war in Yemen, because it was paramount to the BRI. So everybody sort of came together, looked at their self-interest and said, okay, well, we'll let this slide, but China was negotiating that. But the point I'm trying to make is that since 2011, China has put in almost a trillion. They've already established the vast majority of the infrastructure. At least 150 countries have signed on. So this has been in the making for over a decade, and there's substantial progress that's been made. Whereas with the India, Middle East, Europe corridor that the US is proposing, it's new. They don't really have, there's no clear picture as to how it's going to pan out. This is all new theoretical conversations and dialogue and discussions that need to be done, and resolving, like you said, I mean, a lot of internalized conflicts in the Middle East would have to be resolved. And based on the US approach in the Middle East, I don't know how that would work. And it's the same thing with the EU Global Project, who's also trying to basically promote an alternative to the Belt and Road Initiative, but they only initiated that in 2020 or 2021, and there's been no concrete projects. It's very up in the air. And so when you compare that to all the progress that China's been making since 2011 until now, I just don't see it as being plausible. The only thing they're going to try to do is try to essentially disrupt the BRI, by disrupting the entire Middle East. That's a great objective. I mean, war fuels the military industrial complex. War fuels debt colonialism, as we've spoken about many times before. And at the same time, it could serve to disrupt the progress made by the BRI. But that's why I found it very interesting that what I find most interesting about Iran's attack on the 1st of April, retaliatory attacks on the 1st of April, because, and as I said in that video, it goes to show, I mean, Iran basically could have easily not done something like that because, oh, you know, what if the West or Israel attacks, right? And we know that there's always been the desire for pretext for war with Iran. But for Iran to do something like that runs the risk of possibly disrupting some of their biggest economic interests and prospects right now with China, Russia, BRICS, and the BRI. I do believe that they've obviously calculated this very well. There are multiple things and scenarios that they've probably considered. But that's why I also believe that China and Russia are also gave them the approval. They in the sense of, as allies, they probably said, okay, go ahead. And that's significant because their interests with Russia and China in this case are also very strongly attached to the Middle East and to Iran and everything that's happening right now.
Yeah, absolutely. And speaking of the bomb Iran faction, there's no foresight into that. You know, that's been a conversation since like the 80s. They turned the Beach Boys song into it. I mean, it's so old that they turned Barbaran by the Beach Boys into a mantra. Bomb, 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 Iran, bomb, bomb. You know, it's been this idea that's been floating around like what we would now call like neoconservative circles for freaking ever. But there's no plan beyond it. There's no like, okay, we bomb Iran, then what? Oh, another forever war with no exit strategy or no defined or achievable goals. Not to mention what this Iranian strike proved. from last weekend was that, you know, if Israel's vulnerable, guess what is way more vulnerable than Israel? All of United States military assets in the region. They could just be wiped off the face of the map overnight if they really wanted to open it up, because U.S. bases don't have the same missile defense and ABM networks and defense grids that Israel has. Because also, Israel was coordinating and getting targeting data from Saudi Arabia, the Emiratis, the Jordanian Air Force was involved, and then three nuclear powers, U.K., the U.S., and France were involved in, you know, staving off that mass ordnance strike. So not only that, but all of the Iraqi and Gulf oil sites that, you know, America and the West have a vested interest in could also be deleted, like, overnight as well. So what would that do to the global economy and the Western economy and energy security for North America? And, you know, energy security has been one of the driving foreign policy doctrines of America since the post-war order established in 1945. So, yeah, it's just completely without forethought.
Yeah, it would be a suicide mission. The only thing that worries me sometimes is Netanyahu so deranged. That's the only thing. But other than that, logically speaking, if you look at the logistics, like you said, especially what it would, any sort of attack on Iran would cause a kind of conflict that would drive the world economy to the ground, and that would impact the West. But then again, sometimes with the Western elites, they're very good at capitalizing on that sort of thing. Warfare, destruction is something that they can make money off of. But I do think in this particular case, it would just be a suicide mission. But having said that, something that that has been on my mind as well specifically is the, again, going back to the port that they're building in Gaza and their objective behind that port, the so-called humanitarian port. Because the idea was obviously to bring humanitarian aid, right? Even if the conflict, even if the genocide ends tomorrow, and as we've seen, they've obviously removed so many of their troops. Israel's basically left one brigade of a couple of thousand within Gaza. They haven't defeated Hamas. They haven't defeated the Palestinian resistance in the slightest. And therefore, they don't actually have control of any part of Gaza right now. But they're establishing this American port. And that's going to be an interesting one in terms of what that means for the Palestinian resistance, but also then what that means geostrategically for Russia and Iran, because there have been some analysts and some information coming out that the idea is to create a corridor, a maritime corridor within the area between Cyprus and Palestine to control control the Suez Canal and effectively try to counter Iran and China and Russia through doing so. What do you think of that?
Well, I mean, yes, there's also a confluence of other opportunities happening there, too. There's the Gaza Marine Basin, which, you know, even as early as November, the Israeli Ministry of Energy, or I'm not sure what they call that sector. I'm mind blanking on it right now. But yeah, their Ministry of Energy, we'll call it for now. Basically sold the exploration rights to BP in the Gaza to British Petroleum in the Gaza Marine Basin. So that's a big red flag, the signaling intentions. And, you know, we already did an episode where we talked about the complicated territorial mineral rights in that region. But, you know, if they have de facto control over the maritime space in that region, like, who's really going to be in a position to stop them? And you know, we've seen that two different sets of rules apply. You know, there's a one set of rules for America and its friends, and there's another set of rules for everybody else. And that's been blazingly and painfully and shamefully demonstrated since the escalation of hostilities on October 7th.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. So it's the Gaza Marine, which it's definitely going to be exploited in order to make up for the failing economies in the European Union who have been completely deindustrialized because of their sanctions war against Russia that basically boomeranged back on them. But beyond that, what I also see happening is that there's going to be with the port, I think they're going to be using it as a way to militarize that area. And I think as a result, I think we're going to see a lot more attention being brought to that in the future by countries like probably like Iran, Russia, and China, because it's going to be a battle of control of Western Asia at this point. That's what I'm seeing. But at the same time, I don't know how successful that port is going to be. That's a whole other conversation.
Well, you know, if you can't get rid of the resistance, which they're not going to be able to get rid of the resistance unless they literally commit an actual genocide and just everyone's dead or ethnically cleansed from Gaza, the resistance is not going anywhere. They're still fighting in the north, they're still fighting in the south, they're still fighting in middle Gaza. They're conducting complex ambushes on the reg. According to the Office of the Director of National Intelligence, which sits at the nexus of the United States intelligence community, as of like 2 months ago, they were only degraded by 80%. And one thing I like to mention is like that was 2 months ago, but we know for a fact they are actively recruiting and replenishing their ranks as time goes on. Because guess what? They've seen people men who never thought they would join Hamas have been seeing what's happening to their families. Now. Yeah. Oh, yeah. So they're actively replenishing their numbers, and they have an entire new generation of kids that will join up with resistance fronts, not just Hamas, but the PIJ and the Mujahideen Brigades. But because Israel has created a whole new acronym: Wounded Child, No Surviving Family. So I'm sure they won't enlist for military action. It's just absurd. So, yeah, there's definitely going to be multiple problems with that port being effective.
And I think that's the thing. So I can see what the objective is of like the Western imperialist objective. It was there from the beginning, but I just don't think that they're going to succeed. And I think when Iran had essentially retaliatory attacked, Israel was very well aware of the fact that Israel's losing significantly, that the West is unable to actually target Iran in any way. And even the idea of the port that they want to establish, I do think they're going to try to extract the Palestinian reserves, but any other means by which to use that port in terms of military control and strategy, I think it will fail because it's not going to be long-term sustainable. Because much like you said, they have no control over Gaza, and they haven't done anything in terms of defeating the Palestinian resistance. So it's to be seen how things will pan out, but people should definitely be paying attention as to what's happening in the geopolitical scene with BRICS, with the Belt and Road Initiative, because this is the greatest threat to Western hegemony. And yeah.
And so in closing, like final thoughts, this, you know, Mike Johnson's framing this as an axis of evil. It just so happens to correspond to the BRICS countries or to the major BRICS countries. It's a rival influence. I mean, how do you? It's kind of almost unprecedented and impossible to predict. But how do you see a showdown between like NATO and BRICS and the IMF and Belt and Road coming into conflict with one another? Do you think it'll just be like a shadow war for influence, which is what's happening in the Middle East between Iran and Israel and the West? Or what do you see?
It's a tough one. I think this year is going to be a very definitive year, as in how things are going to pan out. Right now, both sides are battling each other. The way I see it, the West's objectives in Palestine and within Western Asia have failed, and I think this will be to the benefit of BRICS, even from a PR perspective, because they're also trying to essentially set up their own institutions. Like I said earlier, they're setting up things like the New Development Bank. So a lot of the Global South, who even if they were a bit on the fence with regards to, you know, where to go, whether westward or whether towards BRICS, I think they're going to gravitate slowly now even more so towards alternatives, given and seeing how brutal the Western regimes have been. in terms of NATO, even, I mean, something that, you know, I guess this is a topic for another conversation, but I mean, that's more, I think what's happening in Ukraine is more suggestive there. And I think some of the reports that have come out in terms of the military state of the vast majority of NATO countries and their actual capability in handling like a war with China or Russia or even Iran at this point is not very promising. So I don't know. I don't see and I don't believe that the West's objectives, even Ukraine, as well as in Palestine, are going to come to fruition. That is my basic analysis without wanting in the last 5 minutes to get into a whole other conversation, because I feel like that's a whole other conversation.
Right. And we can end on optics too. You know, BRICS is looking and China's looking pretty good. I mean, China's doing its own human rights violations. No one's saying that Russia isn't doing like dirty work in Africa with its Wagner Group mercenary proxies in Central Africa.
There's a lot of information coming from Wagner. Like, thing is, anyway, continue.
Yeah, and their involvement with the Janjaweed militias in Sudan with the rapid response forces and stuff. And no one's saying like the Iranian regime is like particularly good. You can just ask about the people in Balochistan, you know. But the massive hypocrisy and brutality of the West is making a lot of these problematic governments that we have framed as like evil look pretty good. And that is definitely a problem for the West. And it makes BRICS look a lot more attractive. And a lot of people are saying, you know, you're supporting Iran. Don't you know about their rampant human rights violations? It's like, okay, well, if you didn't want them to look good right now, you could just not be doing a genocide. If you didn't want Houthis to repair their image and become a regional player, you could also just not be doing a genocide. That's also an option. But of course, nobody wants to talk about that. They want to mobilize the term terrorism as a cudgel to beat down all thought and stuff. And it's just really not working anymore. There's definitely a shift in conversation and optics that's unprecedented, at least since I've been an adult.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's causing people to question what it is that they know, et cetera. But I think it's also when it comes to a lot of these nations, whether it's Iran, whether it's China, whether it's Russia, there's also I believe this has always been my perspective. Organic change will always come whenever it's meant to, right? So the fact that in Iran, there's a vast majority, I think the vast majority of people no longer want a theocracy. They want to sort of replace that with an actual democratic institution where religion is kept separate from the state. I think that's a matter of fact. And I think naturally that's going to happen on its own. It's going to be grassrooted and it will develop within its own time. It's not going to be a Western democratic establishment, but a form of democracy that it represents the Iranian people. And the same thing can be said about other parts around the world. And I think where I'm going with that is there's also a lot of misunderstanding as to what goes on, as in the nuances in these particular countries as well, because we apply a lot of Eurocentric nation state logic to them as well. Yeah. That makes sense. Whereas, for example, even when we talk about Russia or China, we talk about civilization states and what that means and how that comes into play. Like I said, there are changes that need to be done there as well, but I mean, it's not a matter of which is better or which is not better. At this point, it's about geostrategically who can offer in terms of economic viability and economic prosperity, because the only way to alleviate any form of autocracy or oppression is through accumulating the necessary means, the industrial capacity to bring about wealth. And that kind of wealth will bring about change and different sort of structures and different systems that will be specifically coming out of grassrooted movements within whatever country it is that they're coming from. And I think that's the best way for people to emancipate themselves.
And that's what BRICS is increasingly representing for some people, or at least a hope that there is a challenge and another path from the dollar and from Western hegemony. And so you're gonna see a lot of pushback, especially from dudes like Mike Johnson and the Biden administration, just trying to counter it, not with smart policy or anything clever, just throw money at it. $95 billion specifically of stuff that, you know, we could use in America desperately, but it's not, they don't really serve you. Biden doesn't serve you. He serves the capitalists and the controllers of capital more than the constituencies. And
that's why I said before finance. That's why I said finance capitalism or free trade. It does nothing. It doesn't even serve. You know, when we say, "Oh, it, you know, the North, the collective West is basically benefiting from the inequalities by exploiting the South," but it's always has to be remembered. It's a particular 1% that's benefiting, because the working class is also suffering as a result of imperialism and Western finance imperialism as well. Western working class is also suffering extensively.
Yeah. And I think we're about out of time. I hope this was informative for you. This is how BRICS, Belt and Road, the IMF, NATO, and the recent strikes in Iran and the Gaza aid port all tie together in a big geopolitical mishmash that's moving really quickly in terms of changing dynamics and changing landscape. But I hope this served as a good primer that was easily understandable. Thanks so much, Alina, for coming on and talking with us about this.
Thank you, Greg.
Yeah. And speaking about the working class and the controllers of capital, just remember, cops are class traitors. And with that one, we're going to end. Thank you so much. We're going to be releasing this as soon as possible, hopefully Thursday, April 18th or Friday. And then we've got the next episode coming up, I think next Monday, is on German fascism, because it has a special place in my heart, and nobody fascists like my ancestors. All right. Thanks so much, and we'll see you on the next one. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.